I've had it in mind for some time now to do something here at the table about Jesus. I know, right? To some of us, that might sort of sound like, well, duh. You know, isn't it all about Jesus? Depending how you grew up, right? I mean, isn't Jesus like the answer to every religious inquiry, like to every cosmic inquiry, to every moral inquiry? Like, that's the answer, Jesus. What else? I was thinking about this week. What else could a bumper sticker like Jesus is the answer actually mean? There's absolutely nothing on that little truism that defines any of the questions. It's just like this great big gigantic catch-all. And for many of us, that's kind of where we grew up around the Jesus thing. But I know that idea that Jesus is the answer doesn't nearly represent a much wider conversation that's going on these days about Jesus. And it's going on inside of churches, it's going on inside of institutions of higher learning, theological and otherwise, it's going on in the surrounding culture, and I think it's going on inside of lots of us. I had a recent conversation with a friend that summed up what I think lots of people are feeling these days. Lots of people is an ill-defined phrase as well, and since Trump started using language like that, I've found myself more reluctant to do so, but I'm not going to define lots of people this morning, just so you know. This will be a bit of a paraphrase, but the gist of what I feel like I experience in many conversations and a lot of what I read is something like, I'm mostly done with the religion of Christianity, but Jesus continues to intrigue. There are so many reasons to feel disenfranchised with religion these days, not least of all with Christianity. I think as a nation, as a continent, we're post-Christian for lots of easily discernible reasons. And not the least of those reasons are the ways in which that religious banner of Christian, in this context, has been at the leading edge of cultural projects that specialized in certain kinds of violence. And I realize as well that in the last few decades, we have broadened our cultural definition of violence to the point where it's become unwieldy and we're having to kind of reconsider just how finely we want to parse that idea. But nevertheless, I think that's one of the things that's become visible in that process is that Christendom has been one of those cultural projects that has had about it the aspect of violence. I had the delightful occasion this past week at Booth University, where I work part-time, to have a guest in an event that I host there every week, Victoria McIntosh, a First Nations elder, artist, grandmother, just a lovely human being. And when Victoria was introducing herself to us as a community, she described herself in that context, so this is a Christian liberal arts university, as a third-generation residential school survivor. Her grandmother, her mother, and her were all part of residential school life and experience. A uniquely Christian contribution to the history of Canada, right? We don't even have to pretend that that's not a contribution that is saturated in violence. We don't need a wide, generous 21st century definition of violence to include that experience in the definition. So that's an easy target. I realize that's sort of low-hanging fruit, but by way of illustrating the way the culture perceives the religion, there's all sorts of obvious reasons for the disenfranchisement with religion. It turns out that not just within religion, but in other ways, much of the violence is sort of pivots on the way we define ourselves over against the other, and it often turns out that what we mean by the other is basically whoever doesn't conform to the human ideals or preferences of the power holders. Sort of the simplest way I can think of to say that. And we could just sort of parse this degrees of done with Christianity experience, and we would get a range of feelings if we did that. And we would get a range of folks that if you want a continuum, at one side of it there might be people that are militant about retaining a label like Christian that's really important to them. It matters to them, and they're happy to self-identify that way, and they're really not too concerned about what that means to you. They're just, I am a Christian, and that's sort of their starting place. And at the other end of the continuum, we might find people that want nothing to do with that brand, and we would find at every point on a spectrum like that, we would find people that still find Jesus intriguing. That in itself is interesting to me. In fact, my take on it would be that there's a more and more visible movement of people that are looking to the figure of Jesus and the way of Jesus as a potential way of life that define themselves, those people that are looking to that way of life, define themselves, self-identify fairly vigorously as non-religious. That was a terribly convoluted sentence. There are lots of people that define themselves as non-religious that are and say so, that would also be quick to say they find Jesus intriguing. That's interesting. That's not the way the historic shape of this has tended to go. So that's kind of an interesting thing in the culture. And even more interesting, at least to me, is that there's a subset of that general group of people that would readily and quickly define themselves as atheists. That would say, I have no God idea at all. I don't find it necessary. I don't find it interesting. I just don't need it. I am a secular person, an irreligious person, and someone for whom there's no God idea. And I find Jesus intriguing. Also kind of a new conversation in many ways in terms of the history of how people look at and think about Jesus. I'm not going to get into the history of why that is. I think probably we all have a good enough grip on that. And who needs to, you know, come to church for a history lesson? We all do. If you grew up evangelical, as many of us in this community did, you could be forgiven for a couple of things. One is for thinking that evangelicalism equals Christianity. Not true, but easily misconstrued. And the other thing that we might have in common if we grew up that way is that right now our you can't do that meter is creeping toward the red line. You can't think about Jesus aside from a God idea. You can't do that. Many of us, if we grew up in that stream of Christianity, were told over and over again that either Jesus was the Son of God, by which was meant a deity, or someone not worth paying attention to. That either Jesus was who Jesus claimed to be, or a madman, and so on and so forth. This was structured in lots of different ways, but that idea got hammered home over and over and over again. We're not going to get into this today, but that who Jesus claimed to be idea is predicated on an enormous set of assumptions about the nature of the biblical text that we don't all share, and also an idea about that text that's being, in a really thoughtful, meritorious way, called into question by lots of highly regarded contemporary biblical scholarship these days. We'll touch on some of that as we go in this, inevitably. But the upshot of this, if we grew up soaking in that idea that Jesus is equal to God, might be that it's hard for some of us to approach Jesus in any way other than as a deity, other than as the divine. We'll unpack that more as we go, but I think we need to acknowledge the challenge of that, because it's the kind of challenge that closes down part of our imagination. I'm not in saying that trying to lobby for the idea that Jesus isn't God or Jesus is God, or I'm not trying to be positional. I'm saying if you grew up positional on that, using your imagination in another way about Jesus is hard work. And I want to name that challenge in the early going. Sometimes when I'm preparing for the talky bits here at the table, it helps me to think about sort of the wider set of ideas that I'm imagining that we might explore by giving the whole bundle of them a name. So that's a part of my own thought process. If we were in mega church land, which we so clearly are not, we could, headset notwithstanding. I know. It's for the podcast, people. If we were in mega church land, you know, we could put this on the marquee or in the program, or we could, you know, fire hose our social media universe with the news that this Sunday Pastor Tim is starting a series called Series X. And we're not in that land, and I wouldn't call this a series because, you know me, I'm likely to chase off after some squirrel of an idea or other, and we're not going to stay on this for the next 2 months. I'm incapable. But if I did toy, if only in my imagination, with the idea of a bunch of talky bits that I could gather together under a heading, I initially sort of thought about gathering this bunch of ideas together under a heading like Bare Minimum Jesus. And if you saw the subject line in the blurb, you realized that I couldn't stay there. What bugged me the most about that, and the more I thought about it, the less I liked it, but what bugged me the most about it was this implicit idea that regarding Jesus in ways other than the traditional Son of God paradigm was somehow categorically second rate. That bugged me. And it didn't really, that thinking of Jesus that way somehow didn't reach a standard higher than a bare minimum. That bugged me. And to put it quite simply, when I sat with it for a while, I realized that the reason it was bugging me so much is because that's not what I believe. So it's a good reason to be bugged. Now, there might be, I get it, there might be people even in this space this morning that would find some kind of a scandal in that idea. I can live with that because I've realized that I have to live, first of all, with my own beliefs, and only subsequent to that, live with what other people think about my beliefs. I am not an island any more than you. We're communal beings. We're mutually constituted, if you want to take that kind of a perspective on what it means to be human. We don't know who we are without some other way to be ourselves together. So what other people understand about what we believe and think about what we believe is significant. But I think in the end, I have to live myself, first of all, with what I believe, and then with what other people think about it. And I've said in the past here in this space recently, in fact, that some personal knowledge and conviction about where we choose to hang our hats really matters. That the things that we choose to believe enough to act on them, to live into them, what we could call our core beliefs, that those matter. If you know me at all, you know I'm not here trying to make an argument for there only being one possible right set of core beliefs and our primary task being to get to the end of the thin red line of truth and fixate on that point. That's not what I'm describing. Having said that, what we believe enough to act on it really matters. Taya has started to take her rock climbing endeavors quite a lot more seriously lately, which brings me personally some real delight. It's not a daily part of my life these days. Climbing isn't, but for lots of years, climbing was a big deal to me. I trained for it. I traveled for it. I studied it. I considered making guiding a career. And then I realized that I just wasn't a good enough climber to be like a literal rock star. And that it wasn't really in me either to be a kind of a permanently itinerant, no fixed address person. That there was some part of me that really wanted home and some of those things. And so I abandoned that particular dream as a career dream, but I still like to climb. And so when one of my kids gets into it, I probably encourage them, you know, too much. A little vicarious pleasure in that. Anyway, Taya and I were talking last week about the things that you might want to have on your harness as a climber as part of any more serious climb, because she's sort of starting to get into this stuff. By the way, how many of you here have ever climbed, like where there was hardware and things involved? Okay, so that sound right there. Oh, excuse me, I'm not going to get going on it, but there's no sound like the sound of a bunch of hardware, especially if it's like kind of clinking against other pieces of hardware in the rock. And okay, I said I wasn't going to do that, and I just did. So we were talking about this whole, what do you want on your harness if you're getting on a serious climb? What are the kind of things that might help you bail out if you need to bail out, and the things you want to have when you get to the top and you don't quite know what's going to be there and you want to be prepared for that? And one of the things that we talked about was this little piece of rope. This is rather unexceptional piece of little loop of rope, right? I'm not going to get into what makes it an extraordinary little piece of rope, but you want one of these on your harness. And the reason you want one of these on your harness is because it can get you out of all sorts of trouble. And that's sort of in modern climbing. In mountaineering, where I spent part of my time, you want one of these on your harness for a different reason. This is when it's tied like this, it's called a prussic. P-R-U-S-I-K. Don't know why. Probably after the guy who first did it and popularized it. Odds are good. Prussic sling. And the reason it's important is because it's a way to connect you to something that's more permanent. So in mountaineering, one of the things that often happens, if there's a section of the climb that's especially steep or especially slippery or has an especially ferocious downside, someone will go ahead on that section and place anchors and run out a heavier rope and then fix it at either end. It becomes what's called a fixed line, and it's just there. And so when the rest of the climbers come to that section, you need a way to connect to that line while you traverse that section. It protects you. And historically, this has been that way. It's been replaced with all sorts of fancy mechanical doodads, but this is that thing. It's the prusik sling. So it's connected to your harness at one end, and at the other end, there's this super simple little, I'm going to nerd out on knots here just for a moment. There's a super simple little knot that you tie where this just goes around inside. Some of you saw, there's an old Bond movie where he does this with his shoelace and climbs up a rope. Anyway, so there you go. So you just tie it around the rope like that, and then you connect it to your harness. So as you're traveling along the fixed line, which won't be vertical, odds are, a little more horizontal, but you just slide this along the rope like that while you travel, okay? But if you fall, the downward jerk on that, I'm not going to pull hard, it's on a sprinkler line, that tightens up on the main rope and catches your fall. Interesting, right? I got a from Ariel. That's good. So Taya and I were talking about this and about why it matters and how it works and all this kind of stuff, and I started thinking about those experiences and that little line and that big line. And I was thinking about how that whole idea in mountaineering or climbing only works if that main rope, in this case the white and the blue line that's over the sprinkler hose, if that main rope is fastened to an adequate anchor. And that means in climbing that somebody had to climb that section before you. They had to find anchors that were stable and dependable enough to hold the main rope even if somebody falls on it, and to fasten that rope in place. And when I was thinking about metaphors for this experience of Jesus and our encounters with Jesus, it seemed to me that if Jesus isn't anything else, they are this sort of towering historical figure, and that their teachings have demonstrated a kind of robustness over time that makes them likely candidate for providing what we could call life anchors, if you want. The kind of things that we might be willing to bet our lives on if we decide to reach for something that is wider than self-interest or that is, higher than me, me, me. For me, personally, it would be overtaxing the metaphor to think of, the rock the main rope is attached to as immovable or certain. That would be pushing it further than I would be willing to push it, personally. And that's because I don't think certainty is within our grasp as humans, and I don't think that making an argument for ultimate truth in any propositional sense tends to end in anything except sort of these ever-narrowing circles of argument that become more and more exclusive as they go. And I also don't think that that's helpful. That said, I do believe that there is real value in deciding what we will trust. There's real value in deciding what we are willing to put ourselves at risk for. And having done that, there is real life value in going for it with those things in mind and in place. Risk-free? No. Certain? No. Valuable and important? Life-changing? World-altering even? Yes. I think that it's hard to take on anything truly challenging if we have no idea what we have chosen to trust. I actually think that matters more as an idea in the end than the minute particularities of what we choose to trust. I can't think of another way that the world could actually operate than that. Because for one thing, it's full of people who trust things that are different than the things that I trust. And they go on. And they're good. And they do good things. They love and are loved. They care and are cared for. They sacrifice themselves for worthy causes. So on and so forth. We could just keep going with virtues. But if I ask them to be particular about what the fixed line is in their life, they would not define it the same way that I do. I think it really matters to know what we choose to trust. I have a very thoughtful acquaintance that I recently heard use the phrase Christian wisdom keepers, which wasn't a particular collection of words that I'd bumped into before. And she used them, that collection of words, to describe a group of writers and thinkers that they hold in high regard. And I want to suggest that there are ways to explore and even come to trust the wisdom of Jesus that can lead to what I've called here in the past a saved life. Again, just a little tweak on a traditional phrase, right? Miroslav Volf, Volf is a Yale Divinity School professor of theology. Volf calls this the kind of life that I'm imagining when I say that a true life, which is, again, an interesting phrase. And whether your life is guided by a God idea or not, whether you call yourself a Christian or not, whether you want to have anything to do with a church or with a religion or not, I think that there are things in the way of Jesus that can lead to what Wolf calls a true life, what I've sometimes called a saved life. And what I want to do this morning is set that sort of exploration into this, into motion, by considering a particular teaching of Jesus on what many people have called the third way. Now, language of third way is, we'll get to that more in a moment. It's not new, but we are surrounded by either-or thinking. It has a powerful appeal to us as human beings. And, of course, religion's no exception. Lots of what I've already said today makes it clear that I'm not a fan of either-or thinking, either-or relating. And I think pretty much as long as there have been thoughtful people examining ideas, there have been some who have seen this way or that way kinds of ideas as carrying with them some inherent problems. And often those thinkers have looked for what many of them have come to call a third way, a way of approaching difficult or even like it's seemingly intractable problems, a way of approaching those kind of things that fosters creativity and that fosters hope for a better solution than would be offered by binary logic, than either or-ness. So this, again, so that's not a new thing that people have sought that. If you Google third way thinking or third way, where you're most likely to end up is with a lot of information about a particular centrist set of political ideas. That's sort of a high-profile, recent expression of third-way thinking. But the concept is way older than that, and I'm going to suggest that it's at the very least as old as the wisdom of Jesus, and probably considerably older than that. And I should add, just before we get into the particular illustration that I want to use this morning, that this is going to be a bit of a whirlwind introduction to this particular teaching of Jesus, but just to kind of get us going, we'll start here. All of what we're going to do this morning for the balance of our time in the talkie bit is anchored in a particular chunk of one of the most famous and sometimes confounding collections of Jesus' wisdom in the whole Bible, which is the Sermon on the Mount. It's also one of the most compressed collections of Jesus' wisdom in the whole of biblical sacred text. And in particular, the Sermon on the Mount is sort of the most kind of complete full version of it is in the Gospel of Matthew. A number of these particular ideas are also recapped in this so-called Sermon on the Plain, which is in the book of Luke. And that's important, not least of all, because when Jesus speaks as a literary person in the first three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they distinctly speak as a Jew. And when Luke writes as a non-Jew. And so there's this other perspective on these same ideas. Anyway. Here's the text. It will be recognizable to many of us. So this is from Matthew chapter 5, verse 38 and following. You've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. We could camp out right there. We're not going to. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. All right. The either or, the binary, is super easy to see in this text, right? It's in the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, right? If this happens, that happens. If this happens, that happens. It's like this one-to-one correspondence. It's kind of sitting right there. And it's followed by this phrase, which to me always, when Jesus, in the words of Jesus, always says to me, brace yourself for an evolving idea. Like whenever Jesus says this, I'm like, okay, we're moving this conversation forward now. And the phrase, of course, is when Jesus says, but I say, that in my imagination, that phrase has come to be the thing Jesus shouldn't have said if he wanted to live longer. This is kind of what, he bought the farm for this one, you know, like that was it. People were not ready to move the conversation forward, apparently. Anyway, this eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, there's the binary. And then Jesus says, but I say, and then we get to this now familiar idea of turning the other cheek, right? Now, what do we usually take that idea to mean? Well, I think it's fair to say that most often what we do is we turn it back into an either or. We turn it back into a binary. And the way that we do that is we start to imagine that what the idea means is that if someone does us a wrong, if we suffer an injustice, then we need to take one of two paths, either or. Either we roll over and take it, we kind of enact passivity, or we do something equally violent and offensive to get them back, which is basically a way of enacting what we could call the myth of redemptive violence. More on that another time. So turn the other cheek becomes shorthand for suck it up, for be a doormat. And I don't know about you, but I feel quite familiar with that idea and that text being used as justification for the idea that what it means to be a good Christian, say in an abusive relationship, is to just take it. Jesus said, turn the other cheek, right? But to understand that idea that way is to radically miss the point of the teaching. Like, pretty much utterly miss the point of the teaching. We got to do a little bit of history for this part. In Jesus' time and culture, right and left hand signified very different things. This is not esoteric in that culture. This is common to that culture. And that's why Jesus is so specific about which cheek you get hit on first. If anyone strikes you on the right cheek, this would otherwise just be a weird detail. Like, who cares what cheek you get bashed on if you're getting bashed, right? But Jesus is specific about it, and there's a reason for that. And we've talked here before about how in Jesus' time and culture, the right hand was the hand of power, the hand of force, of domination. In that same culture, the left hand was the hand you used for, you know, personal grooming. It was the hand you used to wipe your butt, right? No nice way to kind of go around that. I was going to say but, then it would be a no pun intended, and no toilet paper dispensers in sight. But you didn't, in that culture, you did not eat or touch people with your left hand. So, if you are going to hit somebody in the first century, if you are going to strike them, there were two ways that you did it. You either punched them with a closed fist, your right hand, or you slap them with the back of your same hand, your right hand. So a punch, and we have to remember, to understand this teaching of Jesus, we have to remember that this is a very hierarchical culture. Everybody knew where they were in the pecking order. So it's men first, and then women. It's masters, and then slaves. It's children at the bottom, just next to the livestock. It's a very clearly hierarchical culture. A punch in that hierarchy was how you struck an equal. A punch was how you hit someone that was your peer. Closed right hand. A slap with the back of your hand was how you hit somebody that was below you in the social order. So this is where the right cheek becomes important, part of actually seeing into the wisdom on the teaching. So Jane, I need your help with this. She said yes without me. I gave a little bit. Did I give you a little bit of information? Okay. All right. So what? I'm not actually gonna ask her to hit me. But here's what I want you to try to do. I want you to get this right, and I'm not right, left, whatever. You know. Anyway. So if I asked you to punch my right cheek,
yes,
with your right hand, just show what would that look like?
Terrible.
Right. It just really doesn't work,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So how, if you were going to strike my right cheek with your right hand, try it with a backhand.
Yeah, I can do that.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. This is why this is important, this detail. Because when Jesus says, if somebody strikes you on the right cheek,
right,
Jesus is not talking about an equal striking an equal. Don't go away. Okay? Please. So the only viable way to strike me on my right cheek is with a backhanded slap, to strike me as a not equal. Some of the newer translations of that text have actually picked this up, and they have translated it, and they actually say slaps you on the right cheek as a result. So there's lots of consensus. I didn't just kind of pull this out of thin air in terms of the cultural part of the project. So if somebody was striking me on my right cheek, they were treating me as someone that was below them, as someone that was less than them, someone to be powered up over, to be dominated, to be silenced by a dismissive and a degrading backhanded slap. But Jesus says, if someone does that to you, turn the other cheek. That would be the left cheek. Jane, mm-hmm. You can only hit me with your right hand.
Okay.
Try to punch me with your right hand now.
Yeah, I could do
it. It works great.
Yeah.
Try to backhand me with your right hand now. Show us how awkward that is. Thank you. It just, you'd have to be a, thank you. You have to be a contortionist. Yes, I know. Yes, to do that, right? It's just, it loses all of its power. So what Jesus is saying is that if somebody backhands you, treats you as less than equal by powering up over you, and you stand up and offer them the other cheek, what you are doing is inviting them to treat you as an equal. Try to imagine the subversive power of this in its cultural context, okay? Slave owner and a slave. Pow! Down goes the slave. Now, slave stands back up and turns the other cheek. And now, the person with the power has to choose, because if they wish to strike them again, they have to strike them as an equal. What are their choices? Back down, lose their power, or interact with the person that they were treating as lesser as an equal. It is a brilliant picture of how to subvert the very power holder that is using violence to dominate and dismiss. And then, just in case we kind of missed it with all that left hand, right hand business, Jesus sort of rolls on into these other two illustrations. If anyone would sue you and take your shirt, let them have your coat. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. We're going to explore those next week because we're out of time. But for now, just this. In the wisdom of Jesus, I believe that we can find the kind of true ways of life that can help us as human beings to flourish, to live well with ourselves, to live well with one another, to live well with the earth. And I believe that these are ways of living that can be accessed by anyone. I do not believe that they are the exclusive realm of a religious group or club or social strata. I believe that if we wanted to put it into this morning's metaphor, that the teachings of Jesus can provide us with a kind of fixed rope, a kind of someone's gone here before that can help to catch us when should life bring us those precarious occasions when we slip, that can give us the confidence to move forward even when it's challenging or frightening to do so. And I believe that there are ways to think about all of that wisdom and to live it out that never, ever require us to lord it over someone. Ever. Oh, and I think that I can set the next part of the Jesus wisdom from this text quite reasonably into the context of that recent debacle known as the Kavanaugh hearings. So we'll have a kick at that next week. All right. Peace.